Be one of 500 people to help unlock an extra $10,000 for WPR. Join in now and make a gift for the news and music you enjoy before June 27th at WPR.org/donate.
Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today on the ideas on Wisconsin Public Radio News as we talk about dividing shrubs and perennials on the show today with our guest, Liz Fremont. Liz provides concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hole. So if you have a gardening question, I hope you'll join in. Join in with your comments or questions at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Liz Fremont, good to have you back.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
I am doing fine, and I'm thinking about plants and whether they need to be made a little healthier. Do all plants need to be divided at some point?
Most do. You can get away with just letting some go, and especially those that are going to increase in mass at the crown, and so they are just going to continue to spread outward. You will see that interior die out on most of those over time. But do you have to divide them? No, not particularly. You can just let them die out. That's, you know, it's kind of your choice. But yeah, and right now with the amount of moisture that we're having, the soil is really fantastic. Now is it good time?
Easy time to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we don't, and easy on us and easy on the plants and also easy on the garden because we're not destroying it with a pickaxe and a shovel trying to get something out of the ground. And so when we look at it's time to divide, propagate, et cetera, you want to make sure that anything that you're using is really well disinfested. So your tools, make sure that, you know, follow Brian Huddleston's recommendations for cleanliness. You know, it really, you cannot go too far on making sure that those tools are clean. And you also want to make sure that you're not spreading diseases, critters, et cetera, from one part of your yard to another or to the neighbor's place. So when you are pulling things up out of the ground, look for moving parts that should not be there. You know, oftentimes we don't have the proper eyewear to see, you know, when we're outside working. So you do really want to be aware, is something moving where it shouldn't move? Then get out a magnifying glass or go get your glasses or take a picture with your phone and then enlarge it, see what's going on. Does that mean you shouldn't move it? No, but you can take some precautions so that you're not spreading issues.
What about prune? Should you prune it first before you divide it? Or
to me, I say no, because when I'm out there by myself and I have to rip apart plants, I want to have something that I can gain some leverage on, especially if you're doing grasses, et cetera, where you need something up top to separate and to kind of pull them apart. Then it really depends on the plant, whether they need to be cut back or whether they don't when you transplant them. I'm one of those kind of Darwin gardeners, always have been, that I'm going to do what works for the plant, what works for me, and we'll see what happens. So do you have to cut them back? No. You know, and in the case of shrubs, it was the standard practice to cut a third off the top of the shrubs when you transplant them. Don't do that. Just don't. No. What it does is it creates growth points high up that then forever gives you a pruning issue that you have to take care of, that then results in you having to do renewal or rejuvenation pruning much more often just to get that shrub back in shape. So, you know, the short answer is not, you know, yes, you can't cut some back. Do you really have to? No. You know, like irises, definitely. When I'm in there pruning them or, you know, dividing them, getting them up, I will prune off like about the top half, and sometimes the top two-thirds when I'm pulling them out and dividing them. But really, by the time we're doing that for irises, tops are sometimes looking a little wicked anyway.
Yeah, and this is a good time.
It is a good time, yeah. It is a good time. Now, we do have some irises that will withstand the most abuse you can throw at them. and they will not need to be pruned back at all. So you're going to use your good judgment when you're looking at the top growth on anything you're dividing and moving around and propagating, etc. You're going to look and say, hey, does this look like it needs a little bit of help? And if it doesn't, then leave it alone and see what happens. You can always cut it back later. It's not that big of a deal.
Absolutely. Glenn in Iowa has a question for you. Let's go there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious when and if is a good time to top dress my asparagus that's about 7 years old.
Mm.
Got a bed that's
composted horse manure.
Okay, and are you done with production this year up by you?
No, Father's Day I'll be done.
Okay, so I would say wait until you're done with production. Do some cleanup around the bed if it's got any weeds, etc. on it. And then go ahead, excuse me, and top dress. To me, I want to get some fertility on there right after production. You can do some during production, but I hesitate putting manure on a crop that I am going to pick and then eat. So I would wait until after, just so you don't have any rogue E. coli kind of things hanging around in the composted horse manure. So I would wait until after you finish production, but then get that top dressing on, because as those fronds are up collecting the sunlight to get that those carbs and sugars into the roots for next year, you want to give them plenty of oomph. So wait until production and then go ahead and put it on.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Mark emailed to ask if climbing roses need special fertilizer.
You know, I am not going to second guess our plants. And so I say, go and buy yourself. If you're not producing your own compost / fertilizer / tea, etc., go and buy something that is for roses.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing that I lean to for vegetables, for tomatoes, for peppers, for potatoes, anything like that. If there is a specialized fertilizer made particularly for that, get that. You know, it's formulated for the plant that's on the label, so you don't have to figure it out for yourself. If you're using compost, and roses love feeding, you cannot feed a rose, well, you can feed anything too much, but really for the most part, when they're under production and they're flowering, feed them, they will be much happier and you'll get a lot more blossoms off of them.
And Hamilton emailed, this goes to parsley. He has a strong parsley plant this year and wonders how often should he harvest it in order to keep it healthy.
Well, you always, when you're harvesting, want to leave enough of the plant, whether that's in the stems or in the leaf growth, to, again, allow that plant to take the sunlight in and continue to produce growth. So if you cut it all the way back to the crown, it's going to be much slower coming back. And you can, with parsley, you can cut it off. If you have one plant, that's going to make your harvesting ability quite narrow, because if you're going to pick it all at once and you have to wait for it to come back. My suggestion would be, if you use a lot of parsley, and there are many people who do use a lot of parsley, to put in multiple plants and then harvest them on rotation so that you always have something growing and something coming up. But again, if you leave a good, I don't know how big your plants are, so we're just going to guess. If you leave a good few inches of stem on there, you should be okay.
We have, I'm wondering about new plant variety. You always have great ideas about new flowers and shrubs and so forth. What have you got for us this time around?
Oh, last year, I will tell you, I worked with a hydrangea called Limetta. And then I also have worked in the past with a hydrangea called Ryan Gainey, G-A-I-N-E-Y. Limetta. Ryan Gainey is an older one, so we'll start with that one. It actually is a bit of an improvement on the look of an Annabelle. The stems are stiffer, the heads are a little bit flatter, but they're still kind of roundish, and it's that white hydrangea. So you treat it pretty much the same as you would an Annabelle. And that is a nice one if somebody likes traditional plantings, but with heads, flower heads that stand up better, that's a good one. And I've tested it Only as far north as, about Highway 18. Okay. So I'm not sure what it's going to do further than that, but it is a plant that goes all the way down south also. So it's got a very wide range of adaptability, and it's pretty much problem-free. Again, that one's Ryan Ganey. A lot of the color hydrangeas that are out there are fantastic, but I'm a wait and see on the color hydrangeas because Endless Summer wrecked us all.
Yeah.
That one came out way too fast. And so when I'm looking at a new plant, like in the hydrangea family, that has got this fabulous color, I want to see some trialing on those for 4 or 5 years before I make a call on whether I use them. That being said, I jumped in last year and went with Limetta because I needed something that size and that color. And it's an interesting hydrangea in that it's reminiscent color-wise of lime, of the the little lime, big lime, and but not empanicled. It's round, kind of flattish heads. But it has nice compact form, will only get to be about 3 feet tall, 2.5 to 3 height and width. And the stems stand up again, you know, it's a good one, and comes out white and then goes to a lime green, and that's where it stays. So it's an interesting color for the garden to put into beds when you have some really tight color parameters that you're working with. You know, I've got clients that love orange and yellow, but they hate pink. Or they love blue, green, no red, and, you know, no pink. And this one doesn't like yellow. And so it's always this challenge, and a pleasant challenge, of finding plants that perform within the structure that you've given them. And so those have actually come up pretty good. They've been doing well. They came back well.
Limetta. How's that? Is that
Limetta.
Limetta. Well, it sounds good to me.
Yeah, it's one that is just kind of out there. You know, I like I said, I would like about 4 years on this before I really am gung-ho, but we put a lot of them in and they're looking fantastic, so I can't complain.
Have they done anything with Endless Summer to make it better?
Yeah, they have a couple of different iterations on that. So if you look, and I'm not 100% that they're selling the original Endless Summer as Endless Summer, or if they've updated it and it's Endless Summer 2. Bailey's was the company that was doing a lot of that development work. So I would check in with Bailey's. The last time I met with somebody from that company, she said that they were in like 2 or 3 breeding iterations beyond that, and they're improving it as they go. And, you know, when they're in the perfect spot and they have the perfect conditions, they're wonderful. But that doesn't happen very often. So the other things that are just interesting as all get out are the breeding that's been being done on the natives, you know, or what we term in the industry as nativars. And there's a lot of wonderful plants, a lot of wonderful perennial plants out there that are just looking fantastic. So the Amazonias are wonderful. And I don't know if anybody really talks about Amazonias much. They're a fantastic perennial plant that they're now just finishing their bloom. And because of the amount of breeding that's being done, and mainly by one gentleman, Brent Horvath out of Hebron, Illinois, so northern Illinois, and he has done a wonderful job on breeding and selecting on those plants. And what I like about it is it's early, so we have something with color. And it will range from kind of a really, really ice blue to a dark kind of blue bordering on purple on the flowers. And the common name on them is blue star flowers. So the flowers have kind of a star shape. They're on upright stems. And the leaves, depending on the breeding, can be anything from fine needle-like to wider. And they have got great, really three-season interest. So spring, they're flowering. In the summer, they've got great leaf texture. And in the fall, most of them have got great yellow to kind of orangish leaf color. So it's a fantastic fall plant also. The added bonus is you can hedge clip these things. So once they're done, you can clip them and they'll stay looking great all summer. So, mm-hmm. And I saw a wonderful stand of the species, which can get quite tall up to, you know,
say, like, with a name like Amazonia, Amazon.
Exactly. And so the tall ones, they had them at Meyer Garden in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they have them hedged as hedges. When you walk around, and they look fantastic. I did a double take. I looked and went, my gosh, those leaves look familiar. What kind of a shrub is that? And it wasn't. It was perennials that they were hedging into shrubs. So that was fun.
Liz Freemuth, our guest today, she provides horticultural services all around the country through her business, The Garden Hoe, but she's based right here in Wisconsin. It's great to have her with us. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth. Again, questions for her, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Had a lot of fun last Friday in Bayfield in Bloom, and Bayfield in Bloom is continuing. It's got its garden tour, I wanted to mention, on Saturday from 10 to 3, and you'll be able to see the plants at some of Bayfield's finest gardens. And one of the stops is a native plant garden that welcomes visitors to the main entrance to the Brownstone Trail. It's a great, very popular local trail, and it was established through trail easements held by Landmark Conservancy. And some folks from Landmark are going to be present to talk about the native plants, and maybe there's even a plant sale connected with that. So that's Saturday from 10 to 3. Wanted to mention that from the good folks in Bayfield. Well, Dean in Iron River has a question for you, Liz. Let's go there.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. My name is Dean. I live in Iron River. I grow pumpkins. I actually planted them at my house in Colorado, but I put them in the ground a week ago here. And they've come up nicely, and there's, you know, 4 or 5 leaves on each plant. I'm trying to figure out how I should be feeding them or fertilizing them along the way as they grow.
What are you looking for? Are these eating pumpkins? Are they for Halloween, or what are they for, Dean?
Are you in competition?
Well, I've got 4 kinds, actually. Big Mac, Cinderella's, mm-hmm. Connecticut Field, and New England Sugar.
Okay, so
a little bit of both.
Max,
some of them are for show, and some of them for eat.
Yep.
You can fertilize. Did you put anything in your soil to start with?
No, I just got like the seedling soil from Home Depot and put them in little trays, and that's how I started them and transplanted them when I got here.
Okay, so the bed that you planted them in, is it in ground, above ground?
It's in ground, but I mounded it a bit. You know,
okay.
So there's like a.
Yep.
Okay. You can over.
And it's pretty rich. The soil
it
is pretty rich. It's
okay.
Down near a wetland, and it's been gardened for decades. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
If this is a particular crop, as you have pumpkins, this is a great opportunity for you to get a soil test done, because if you're going to grow pumpkins, they have very specific needs, like every crop does. They have very specific needs. And they're high feeders, especially as they're growing. But you may, if it has been gardened for a while, you may actually be okay fertility-wise, other than maybe a little kind of general purpose. But I would say, you know, if you have not planted there before, get a soil test done. They're really quick on turnaround. And you can do that through the soil lab. Just go to UW Madison Soil Lab, and you can send your sample in, tell them what you want to plant there, you know, what is there right now. But then they can give you very specific guidelines as to, do you need nitrogen? Do you need phosphorus? What do you need? And then you're not going to over under fertilize on these, especially if you're growing for size. because the max, generally people want to grow those big. And so you do want appropriate fertility for them. You know, in lieu of that, if you cannot, don't want to, et cetera, do a soil test, which, again, highly recommend, that you can go and, as we talked about before, get a fertilizer that is appropriate for vegetable, you know, vegetable production, squash in particular. And that should at least get you on the right track. But again, you may not need it. You may just need some compost and everything will be fine. Good luck with it.
Just takes the guesswork out of it.
It really does. And especially for a new site. Yeah. Or a new crop in a new site. Rotation is huge in vegetable gardens for that reason. I mean, it's for pests and diseases, but also for fertility. And when you rotate crops, you want to rotate in a fashion that you have something in that is going to be a heavy feeder one time. The next time you want to put something in that is actually going to replenish the soil, and you're still going to have to add fertilizer, et cetera, to it, yeah. Organic material, but at least that gets you on the right track.
Good luck with that, Dean. Thank you so much for calling. I want to hear how those pumpkins grow later on.
Send some pictures.
Oh, boy. Don in Fort Atkinson, we'll go to you. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a property on the banks of the Rock River, so it's fairly wet. And it's also populated by lots of walnut trees. Someone gave us some peony plants. They have not bloomed in several years.
Right.
Is this a reasonable time to move them? And are they doomed if it's an area that's somewhat wet, although it does dry out, and has walnut trees? The plants are outside of the drip line of a walnut, but probably still affected by leaves, et cetera.
Yeah, they will be. The juglone does really encompass every part of that walnut tree. And peonies are coming up as a mix as to whether they react super negatively to juglone or not. So you will get anecdotal evidence from people both ways, that they'll tell you, yeah, I grew peonies under my walnut tree and they were fine. Well, there are some peonies that will do okay in growing in conjunction with walnut trees. But if they haven't bloomed for several years, if they look healthy and they're not getting wimpy on you, then it may not be the walnut itself, but it might be how deep you planted them. Peonies are, they love a shallow planting. And my rule of thumb with planting peonies is if you think it's not deep enough, it's perfect. Yeah. Because you should have that response where it's like, ooh, I think I should put it deeper. But no, you don't. They don't like it. They love cold. They will tolerate a little bit of dampness on their roots, but not consistent moisture. And I've got a couple that I'm trying in an area that gets periodic flooding when it rains really heavy, and they're not the best flowering peonies, and they're not the strongest. So given the kind of root structure that a peony has, it's very fibrous, it's very big, I don't really think that that's one that I would say, yay, let's put it underwater. So you might want to dig that out and experiment. If these are peonies that you're okay if you lose one or two, experiment and dig some of them up and move them into an area that's a little bit more well-drained. Plant them a little bit shallower and then leave one or two where they're at and see what happens as a difference between the two of them. Peonies are generally really easy. The date for moving/dividing peonies, as was told to me by, you know, the wonderful, wonderful man, Roy Clem, is he said, Liz, August 17th. That's the date. And I was like, why? And he said, August 17th. I went, okay, thank you, sir. That was it. If he says August 17th, it's August 17th. That's when the production people actually start dividing, digging, moving peonies. And so that gets us past the point of flowering and that point in the plant where they're rejuvenating their roots. And they're going into somewhat of a dormancy state. So in August, that's the time when you can cut them back if you don't like where they're at, you know, if they're getting rangy or whatever. Or you can dig them up and start dividing.
There you go, Don. Thank you so much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Jan in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
My question is that the asparagus beetles got to my asparagus this year, and the tall fronds have virtually no fuzz on them. Mm. They're just the little stems. So I'm wondering, what do I do from here?
Let me ask you this. Do you have a lot of weeds around the area?
Or not is it now.
Or is it fairly clean?
I cleaned it out. That's when I discovered the asparagus beetles.
Yeah. Those stinkers love it when you've got a little bit of grass or weed growth or something like that in there. Then you'll see a higher population of those. I would say at this point, don't cut your fronds back because you need that for the system to get rejuvenated, get the carbohydrates back into the roots for next year. So I would say, and what I have done in the past that has worked well, I've got a couple of wild patches that I don't take that good of care of. I will actually burn them off in the spring, early in the spring, and get all of that, all of those weeds and the debris up. And I do that before they actually start popping up out of the ground, definitely. And so once those fronds turn kind of that lovely golden color and they start, you know, in your case, the little stems are going to start falling over a bit, or they're just going to start to dry out, then you can actually go in and do a little bit better cleanup on that bed if you see something coming up. And you might want to fertilize, you know, again, soil test or whatever, but get something on those so that they can actually come back stronger next year for you. But then do a nice cleanup on it. You know, do a fire cleanup if you can. If not, just do a really, really nice early spring cleanup so that you can minimize that. But by getting rid of the debris around that bed, you are then not giving those beetles a place to be. So that'll give you a few jobs to do.
Jan, good luck, and thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Louise in Dodgeville. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I have a question about a spirea shrub and dividing it and replanting it. Can it be divided into three? And I guess just your recommendation.
Okay, which type of spirea do you have? The white flowering or the shorter color type?
It's kind of pink, and it's growing really quickly. It's kind of big.
Yeah. Okay. The flowers are pink.
They are.
Okay. And the leaf color, is it kind of a chartreuse or is it a green?
Green.
Okay. And when you look at the base of that shrub, does it look as though you have a lot of little stems coming up out of the ground, or is it really just two or three big stems?
Good question. I'm looking out the window at it right now, so I couldn't answer you.
Okay,
but
so I'll give you, I will give you the answer for both of them. So that way you can kind of decide. You can wander out there and take a look. So if you're looking at a shrub, a spirea, that has a lot of side growth. So when you look at the shrub itself, the main stem, you're going to sit on the ground, you're going to get underneath those branches, and you're going to take a look at the structure that's in there. And what you want to look for is, does this have really heavy, big, thick stems and only a few of them? Or does it have that and maybe some smaller ones starting to poke up out of the ground alongside of those? And if that's the case, then you can take off those little ones that are growing next to the main shrub, next to the main trunks on that shrub. You get your shovel in there and you slice down vertical. And, you know, and experiment with this because it might take you a couple tries to get what you want, but don't worry. And then if you cut through that stem, it's probably going to be coming off of the main stem root area, shooting sideways a little bit, and then heading up. So give it a whack. What you should pull up out of there is a stem with a bunch of little hair roots on it. And It, that alone, if it looks good, and there's more than like one, and I will tell you I've even planted one, some that have just one little root on them. It takes them longer, but they do come around. But that you can just plant into a new spot, and you're good to go. Now, if it's if you don't have that side growth and you only have the big main stems, then if you divide that, you're probably going to kill it. So what you're looking for is that side, those little side suckers that are growing up. And those you can take as, I don't know how big your shrub is, so I can't tell you how many to take, whether it's 3, 4, 8. So you can just kind of play around with that. Does, again, take some time to go from one little sucker into a shrub, but you it will do fine. If it's a plant that's happy, it will do fine when you cut it and you move it. Now, with those spirea, the pink flowering ones, you can cut those very close to the ground every spring to keep that height under control a bit. And you do that, you know, like February-ish time, and you just be brutal, give it a hack and whack. That is for a shrub that has a lot of growth. We can go back to if it's one that has a few main stems on it, you may have to work your way down to a short cut. It may take 3 or 4 years. So those shrubs that have been kind of left on their own and gone, woo, I'm happy, they're also going to have larger stems. And so you would take maybe 3 years and cut off part of it, and then the next year you cut off more and encourage that side growth.
Louise, does that help?
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome. Good luck. Send us pics.
love that answer. Louise, thank you so much. We had an email from Cindy in Janesville. She planted red creeping thyme ground cover and was surprised to read that they have a plant life of 5 years only.
Mm-hmm.
Would splitting them or growing cuttings help prolong these plants? Also, that's part of her question. Then she planted sedum ground cover, and 3 days later, they were gone.
They were gone.
Looks like an animal dug them up. She's reluctant to plant more sedum.
Yeah, I would be reluctant to plant more sedum too. I would look around the yard and see if you can find those sedum stashed somewhere. Because sedum is, it's tough. It's like a hosta. You can tie it to the bumper of your car, drive around town and do your shopping, come back, plant it, and they would do fine. So, you know, that, you know, if it got taken out of the ground, I wouldn't worry so much unless it's completely and totally gone. But you do probably want to figure out what's digging in your beds. And so this might be a good opportunity to do one of two things. And that is either come out with a flashlight in the middle of the night and see if something's active, or get yourself an inexpensive trail cam, put it out there and see what is digging around. Because the only way you can successfully defeat your foe is to know who and what your foe is. And it, you know, if it's a chipmunk or something like that, oftentimes putting down uncomfortable things for them to walk on or dig in will move them over to a plant that's a little bit easier for them to get to. So the sedum itself, it's a wonderful plant. There are so many types out there that can just answer almost every need. They take hot, dry, they just keep coming back more and more, and they're easy to propagate. It's just pinch them off and throw them on the ground, and they're usually happy. So I would not give up on the sedum. I would see who your problem is and then figure out whether you can fix it before you give up on the plant.
Trail cam might be kind of fun for, anyway.
It is.
for anything.
I had 1 year horrible, horrible raccoon problems in my pots. And it didn't matter what I did. I put fencing up on them. They'd rip the fencing down. I sharpened bamboo stakes and put them all over in it. And it was horrible because they kept coming back again and again. So I got a trail cam, put it out there to see what it was first. And it was the raccoons. And just to watch their behavior was fascinating. I stopped trying to keep them out of the pots because it was really fascinating to watch. The next year I did a better job and they didn't get in. Yeah. You have to know what you're dealing with in order to figure it out. But to her red, thyme.
Yeah, red creeping thyme.
I have had friends who have done creeping thyme as ground cover in a lot of spots. And it does have a lifespan, but also it will actually root as it moves around. So as that plant matures, you will actually see those creepers that are along the ground. If you kind of give them a little tug, they do root down in there. Now, if it looks like the mother plant is dying off, you might want to encourage those and cut them off from the mother plant as they kind of develop and root and take hold. And so that will actually, you'll be able to propagate that way. Seed grown thyme and lay people propagating thyme is a time consuming thing.
Yeah.
It's slow to germinate. It's slow to grow. So if you can actually work with what Mother Nature is doing itself with that plant, then you might be able to keep that for quite some time.
Violet in Cedarville, Illinois, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Violet.
Good morning, everybody. I have a Cora Bell garden plot, and it's getting invaded with lily, invasive lily of the valley. And I'm hoping that you can suggest something for me to spray just the lilies of the valley and keep the Cora Bell.
Well, boy, I'm not 100% on whether you can use a, I would have to actually look. I'm not sure whether Lily of the Valley is a monocot or not. If it is, again, I'd have to check. I cannot pull that one up out of my head. Larry may pull it up while we're talking. But if that's the case, then you can't, there are grass killers out there that do not bother herbaceous, you know, just plants, but the dicots, but it will take out the monocots. And so that would be the only thing that you could do.
Monocots.
Yeah, if it's a monocot, then a grass killer alone would do it. What I would suggest to you, though, is that perhaps you have a professional do that, because there are a number of products that professionals only can use, and they're much more effective than what you can get off the shelf as a homeowner. And so you might want to check into that. But grass killer only is what you can use. Or you might want to just yank them out and put them in a bucket and go online and say, hey, free lilies of the valley. And if you want to pull them out. But they are tough to control once they get going. Good luck with it. I hope you can find a decent product.
I hope so, too.
Oh, they're out there. It's just whether a homeowner can get them. That's all.
And thank you very much for calling, Violet. Appreciate it. Liz Freemuth, our guest today, her business, The Garden Hoe. Questions for her? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth, who provides horticultural services all around the country, really, through her business, The Garden Hoe. Take a look at her website, thegardenhoe.com. I like that site. Rainbow in Madison has a question for you, Liz, so let's go there. Hi, Rainbow.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I own a house, and a previous owner, I think, planted bindweed, or I think it's like morning glory, and it's all over my yard, and I love gardening, and I just don't know what to do. I'm trying to find organic solutions to get rid of it.
Yeah. What? Let me ask you this. What type of flowers are on this bindweed / morning glory?
Well, usually I try to pull it out before it gets to the flower, but they look like morning glories.
So purple, blue, something like that, or are they white?
Yes.
Okay.
No, they're, well, actually, I think they are white.
Little,
now that you say that.
Okay, so size of the flowers, is it closer to 1 to 2 inches or 2 to 4 inches in size?
No, definitely like 1 to 2.
Okay, yeah, you got the tough kind. Yeah, it's
of course.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And you know the really wicked part about, because it sounds more like field bindweed than it does morning glories. Morning glories, even though they can be somewhat invasive, they're easier to control. The vines are bigger, the leaves are bigger, the flowers are bigger, and the roots are not quite as extensive as field bindweed. Field bindweed is going to really creep along the ground more than it is going to want to climb up on something, although it will climb into anything and on anything, but you will see it all over the place. And the roots on these things can go, you know, 20, 30 feet underground. And so you're looking at controlling something that is creeping at you from underground. And every place you pull that, you're really creating
more.
Yes. I was going to try and say that a little more gently, but yeah, Larry's right. You're making more plants. So what you want to do is you want to cut those off. And I mean, I know this is going to seem absolutely ridiculous to tell you this, because you're going to say there's no way I have enough time for this. And you're right. Nobody has enough time for it. But it's a matter of, even though you want to do no chemical, I don't think you're going to handle it that way. So what you need is a weed killer of some kind. And you go through and you find where they're coming up out of the ground. You cut them off. Take a little paintbrush, and I mean, you know, like a foam paintbrush. Paint that tiny stem. And then go on to the next one. And then what you want to do is remove the debris from that, especially if it has flowers, because those seeds are viable on those flowers very early on in the process. So you do want to get that debris out. And I know I just said something that you're rolling your eyes at, because I would too, because the task is unbelievable. But there's really nothing else you can do.
Somebody told me that glyphosate was the only thing that you could actually totally kill.
Right.
Field bindweed.
Right. And you have to be really targeted in that,
yeah,
too. Either that, or you just redo the entire yard and just kill everything off and start over fresh. It really is kind of a 50-50, and I mean that seriously, 50-50. If your yard is 50% weed and it's 50% whatever else you've got, you're better off just starting off fresh, cost-wise, time-wise, et cetera. Whether that's doable or not is another matter. Because, you know, really, those roots are going to be in the soil. So if you just cut them off or pull them off at the surface, they're going to keep sprouting from the ground, unfortunately. I hate to say stuff like
yeah,
that.
Not spreading such great news for you, Rainbow.
No. So sorry.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Catherine in Port Washington, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. Thank you for being on the air today.
Sure.
I have a Japanese maple that's 23 years old. It's beautiful and healthy, and it's never been pruned.
Mm.
And I've consulted with a few professionals just to, like, clean it out and prune it. And an arborist wants to come and do this now, but I've talked to other professionals, and they told me to wait until fall or winter. So, and I have two other quick questions after that.
Sure. There are schools of thought on should you only do it during the winter time. You know, yes, because you are going to reduce the potential of getting diseases and insects into that fresh tissue by trimming it when the diseases and insects are not present. But we also have to take into consideration what it works for you.
Exactly.
So we can go perfect, quote unquote perfect, and do it when all the stars align, or you may have to do it now. Because if you have a tree that has not been pruned for 20 years, you may have some crossing branches, you may have some broken branches, you may have things that if you don't take care of them now, they're going to rub and open up vectors for those insects and diseases to get into anyway. And so if we have some nice dry weather. Can you prune them during the summer? Definitely. I would avoid avoid any time where it's moist and damp, which for us is most of summer. But should you really do it during the winter? Yeah, you really should during the dormant season for that plant. And we really do look more toward January, February, decent days. Again, not much moisture in the air, et cetera, et cetera. And with a deciduous tree, it's much easier to see what's crossing, what's not. So it may actually, the answer may be twofold. Get in there and see if there are crossing disease branches that need to be removed. Get those out of the way and then do a dormant season pruning.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Yep.
You had another question or two.
Yeah. I do have a lilac tree and mm-hmm. it's bloomed for 8 years, 7, 8 years, and now it's not blooming anymore. Mm-hmm. And what I do in fall, as I know, I take like, I just kind of trim the top off to kind of shape it. But I'm thinking that inward needs to be pruned and dead wood taken out.
Is it a tree? Oh. Did you say it was a tree?
Yes, it's a lilac tree.
So it's
beautiful.
The Peking lilac?
Yes.
White flowering or yellow kind of?
No, it's purple flowering.
Oh, okay. Then it is a lilac that has just trained itself into a tree. So it's done flowering. It should have flowered, and you're looking at seed heads probably on it right now, right?
Yep, but I had very few flowers this year. Very few.
Okay,
and
but
I took the hedge trimmer in fall, and I went around it to take everything off and formed it, but something's not right.
Well, what you did when you did that in fall, you know, you go, girl. You got out there and you trimmed it up. Do that now instead of in the fall, because for lilacs or for anything that's spring blooming, prune it right after it flowers, because they flower on old wood. And so in fall, what you did is you probably cut off a lot of those bud blossoms that were on the ends of the branches. And so you didn't get a lot of bloom because you cut a little bit down too far, took the blooms off, because they will prune them now. Then as that wood develops through the summer, the bloom buds will develop on those branches, and then in spring they pop out. So if you prune now, they have a chance to develop. If you wait until fall, those bloom buds have already developed, they're on the branches, you cut them off. And they don't have time to renew before they're ready to bloom in the spring. So my suggestion would be, first off, let's give that a try and see if that was what did it this year. If the leaves look healthy, if the tissue on the trunk and the branches looks healthy, then I wouldn't worry about it tremendously and just look at what your pruning time is and kind of adjust for the natural growth and development of the shrub.
Catherine, there you go.
That goes for Miss Kim, too, the Miss Kim bushes.
Yep.
That now, too.
Thank you so much. The only one it doesn't that is a little bit different is the Peking lilac. But, again, that's a prune after it flowers, and you'll be fine.
I love those Peking lilac.
I do, too. They're so pretty. They look so pretty light.
Pretty smell.
Yep.
Really smell great. I have one right outside by the front porch, and it's lovely to sit out with a cocktail and take it in.
I was just talking about cocktail shrubs the other day, and one of my favorite is calycanthus. Yeah, it's Carolina sweet shrub, and we never knew it would grow up this far. And about 10 years ago, I started bringing them up, and people were trialing them up here, and they are doing fantastically. And that one, the blooms start to smell about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Timing.
It is. Yep.
Well, let's see what's on Beth and Eau Claire's mind next. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I have an apple tree question. Is there a general homemade spray to deter worms? I talked to my county extension agent, and she said, well, what kind of pests do you have? And I don't want another season to go by. And so I'm just wondering, there's something I can spray. It's a general spray.
Are you talking, I mean, do you have worms that are an issue?
Every year, wormy apples.
Wormy apples. Okay, you need to get on a program that starts before the leaves actually come out on the trees, or else they are already present. So I think this year, let's use this year as an education year. And I would look at, Extension has some great information on home growing apple trees. Get on a program and you should be fine.
And thanks, Beth, for calling. Liz Freemuth, our guest, she's going to be with us right up until 1 o'clock today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth, who provides concierge horticultural services all around the country through her business, The Garden Hole. Questions of an open line for you at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Ellie in Eau Claire next. Hi, Ellie. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for being here, Larry. I have a horrible thing. It's called bishop's weed or gout weed or snow on the mountain.
Yep.
What can I do about it?
Yeah. How much do you have?
I have a lot. It's probably a third of the backyard.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
That's another one of those that I hope you're not opposed to chemicals, because that's what it's going to take.
Actually, I am. That backyard is used by my dogs and my cat.
Okay.
I've tried using horticultural vinegar, and that seems to cut back the foliage. But is there anything I should do after the vinegar?
That's all it's doing, is maybe burning the foliage.
Yeah, it's the acid burning the foliage. And when you do that, when you use horticultural vinegar, whatever it is, regular vinegar, you are messing with the composition, the pH levels in the soil for the other plants as well. What I would suggest then, if you're opposed to this, because it is going to be the same thing as we had talked about earlier with the bindweed, where you pull it out, you're going to make more plants. And so what I have used for Creeping Charlie and for, you know, that mint plant that you really had to have and you had to put in and then it went all over the yard, that's another one that it really anytime you pull, you're just going to make more plants. You're helping it rather than hurting it. What I have done is go to mowing it short, so that either with a weed whacker or with a lawnmower, mow it short and just keep mowing it. And I mean short. You don't want to break the crown, but you do want to mow it off short. And sometimes with these plants, goutweed is going to take forever, but sometimes with them, what you are doing is you're just pushing it into dormancy. It's not that it's going to go away, but you're pushing it into dormancy. And do the dogs chew on it or anything? Is it annoying to you? Is it in the grass? Is it a bed? Where is it?
Well, it's in the grass. It's gotten into my daylilies, and it's in the area that I like to put my tomatoes and whole beans and all that stuff.
Yeah. So, okay, then if this is like a garden bed kind of area, then I would also try something else I've done with ditchweed lilies that I put into an area thinking that's great. I don't care what they do. Well, I should have cared what they did. This was, you know, like 30 years ago. And what I ended up doing was digging out everything. And I sifted the soil after I did that. So I would dig a shovel, put it onto, you know, use a window screen or something like that. And you would sift the soil into a wheelbarrow and then stack that somewhere, you know, put the soil somewhere else.
Oh, man.
And I went through the bed, you know, shovel by shovel, and pulled out every single root I could find. And I still had things coming up. You know, 15 years later, you get one sprouting up. So it's going to be an ongoing fight. But if you don't want to use chemicals on it, those are kind of the options that you have. If it's in the grass, I would say cut it off and don't worry about it tremendously. in a bed where you want to plant, then I would say, yep, you're going to have a really long road to getting that under control. But I think, you know, putting it off is only going to make the problem worse. So just dive right in and take it on as your task for this year. Get rid of that stuff and make sure that you've got decent soil. You're going to keep doing this for a good probably 4 or 5 years. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I suppose you could cover it.
You can do solar on it. You can do cardboard, you know, to kind of smother it. It is going to push it into dormancy. Those roots are really, really tough. But that might be enough. It might be enough for you to push it into dormancy and just move forward. In a vegetable bed or an area where you want to plant something that doesn't have as tough of a root system, then you're letting the thug be there and kind of beat up on your good plants. Anytime you've got a really wicked weed problem like that, it's almost best to put in another thug and let them duke it out. But in this case, I don't think you want to do that. You got a big enough of a thug in your yard anyway. But just, you know, go at it, get down in there, try to cut the roots as little as possible. So when you're digging, you start from one end and work your way through and get underneath those roots and get out as much as you possibly can.
Good luck, Ellie. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Pam in Madison. Hi, Pam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a viburnum, and last year I learned it had viburnum leaf beetle because the leaves just had all these bitty holes. And then I didn't treat it, and this year there's, like, it's just sticks. And I wanted to dig it out and replace it, but will they affect any other plants?
Anything that's in the viburnum family, yes. And excuse me, there may actually, it's probably a PJ or a Phil question more than it is me. But yes, they will come back again and again. You can treat for it. You can have someone come in. I would have a professional come in, use a good product that is going to kill off those beetles. And they're going to treat the ground probably, and they're going to treat the plant itself. They will come back unless you've let it go. You know, if the leaves were completely gone this year, you still can actually get them to come back. And especially if I burn them, if it's like a blue muffin or something like that, that will regrow nicely after it's cut back, then you can do that. But unless you actually control that beetle population, it will keep coming back again and again. All insects will have they'll have a population level that will increase, hit a plateau, and then it'll decrease slightly, but you will still have them. So those, I would say, get them out. I have to check to see what they don't eat, but just stay away from the viburnums.
Yeah, for sure. Pam, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Therese in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Therese. Therese, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thanks for the show. A quick question about my knockout roses and a climbing rose. The first blooms are always really the nicest, and they do well, eastern exposure, but it looks like something has got to them, and it's too early for Japanese beetles, maybe a mite or something. Some of the leaves are wilted. Not wilted, but I'm just wondering, I had fertilized them with an insecticide base, you know, and fertilizer, which said it took care of some critters or little bugs. So any suggestions?
Did you use a systemic or was it a spray?
It was systemic.
Okay. And that should, if it was a good kind of all-purpose systemic, and you, when did you put that down?
About 6 weeks ago.
Okay, so it should have had enough time, especially with the amount of rain that we've had, to really get into that plant system and up into the stems and leaves, etc. Without seeing what it looks like, I cannot tell you if it's insects or diseases. One of the most wonderful tips that Phil Pelletieri gave me early on when I was a novice was take a white sheet of paper, put it underneath that leaf, and then tap the leaf and see what falls onto that white sheet of paper. And then have a magnifying glass ready, or a microscope, or whatever you happen to have, and take a look at what you're dealing with. Because insecticides do not always, they are not always formulated, and more often than not formulated, to handle eight-legged insects. So you're talking about a product that would kill six-legged ones, but not eight-legged ones. And so you would need to get, if it's a mite, you'd need to get a miticide or something on that order to handle that type of a problem. So what you want to do is, as we talked about earlier, figure out who your foe is before you start fighting. Because if you're using the a product that doesn't cover that, then you need to add something else to that. It may be that you need a spray miticide on that. Again, can't tell without looking at it. So if it looks like a disease on it, there are no little specks, black specks that fall onto a piece of paper, and you look at them and it's not an insect, it's just dirt, then you may have a disease issue going on. And Brian is fantastic. You can send him a picture and he can tell you what it is or is not, often by the picture. So give those a try. You know, to see if you can figure out what you're dealing with. And then you might just need a little bit extra product, because right now, everything, the roses have been looking fantastic. So yeah.
So should yours.
Yeah, we want yours to look beautiful too. So see if you can figure out what's going on.
And thank you for calling, Therese. Let's take a call from Tim in Madison next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, I have some beautiful a bleeding heart plant, and it's done blooming now, and I know it needs to be divided, and I'm just looking for some advice about how and when to do that.
You can do that now. What type of bleeding heart do you have? Is it the mini? Is it an old-fashioned white or pink, or is it the chartreuse leaf? Which one do you have?
It's pink, and then it has some white to it. Like the top part, the heart part, looks like it's pink, you know?
With a little white on the bottom?
Correct.
Yeah. Those you can divvy up now. They're done blooming, so you can do that now. They will actually definitely go into dormancy when you divide them. Oftentimes, if we have enough moisture and the temperatures are coolish at night, you will get the bleeding hearts to stay in their leafy form for quite some time over summer. But I have found that when I divide them out in early summerish, they will often go into dormancy, so don't worry if the top growth disappears when you do this. So dig it up out of the ground and take a look at what you have for root. It should, when you dig it up and lay it out on the ground, you should be able to divide that, depending on how old it is, at least in half, if not into thirds. And you can just pop those back in the ground. And you should be good. Again, don't worry if the foliage dies right away, if the top growth dies right away. It will be fine.
And good luck, Tim. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly here at Open Lines. We had a caller we just lost, unfortunately, who had river birch problems, and she'd been on hold, or he or she had been on hold for a while, so we might have just gotten out of his or her phone range. Well, so, and we were kind of joking, and you were saying you were hoping.
Yeah, I was hoping it was pink slime, because that's just so cool. Birches can get a bacterial infection that is not fatal, but it will kind of ooze pink out of a wound, and that generally happens, you know, or a little bit earlier in the season, but it can happen now. But that's kind of a fun thing. It looks like somebody's got chewed loose bubble gum coming out of the tree, but otherwise it may be with birch. It may be bronze birch borer if you're seeing, if you're seeing
birch leaf miner,
any of that kind of thing. If you're seeing damage or dieback from the tips in, that's generally treatable. Get an arborist out there to get the treatment on for you. And if it hasn't gone too far, they usually rebound just fine.
There you have that. I'm not sure. I think those are the three.
Those are the main ones, yeah. Yep.
You can join in, as I said, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Eve was sent an email about parsley and said it's a biennial, so the first year plant that we harvest doesn't have a few inches of stem to leave growing. She says she would suggest harvesting older leaves and leaving the least, at least half of the leaves growing.
Yeah, it really depends on the cultivar that you're growing. There are some that are short, and as gardeners, we have to make judgment calls every single day when we go out and look at our plants. And in her case, you know, she's doing what works in her yard, and that is kind of what's important. We can give you guidelines, but you know, every time there's a guideline, there's going to be a wrench in that guideline. Parsley is a very tough plant, though. So, and I do know that plants that I have, they're taller than a few inches. So it's, you know, it really is what kind you buy and when, and, you know, it's a lot of art based on science. And I take her very seriously, and it works for her. So there you go.
Jerry in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Help me get rid of my buckthorn. I've been snipping the trees, they're probably, let's say, an inch to two in diameter, some even smaller, close to the ground, and then painting them with a broad spectrum spectracide, hoping that takes care of them. It's infesting my forest, and I just want to get rid of them. Is that a wise approach?
It is. You can also rip the smaller ones right out of the ground. And so if you're getting them early, so if you're out there eradicating the larger ones that you cut off and paint, you may have to do that a few times, because buckthorn is really tough. That is a tough one. But if you can catch it early, then you can just rip it out of the ground. And, you know, hey, don't go to the gym, go to buckthorn. Why not, right? Mm-hmm. I heard that. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, yeah, that really is about the best approach, is to cut it off and paint it. Often I find that to be a good 2/3-man job, so that somebody is cutting and a couple other people are going behind and painting. You do want to get that product on as soon as possible after it's cut, so you don't want to go through and cut your entire woods and then come back and treat, because those cells may have closed off, and so you won't get the product up there as quickly as what you could if you had somebody following you directly. I've also found that if you paint the sides, so you paint the top, but then also around the vertical part of that cut, just right underneath it, that can sometimes help to speed it up a little bit.
All right, Jerry, there you go. Thank you for calling. Barbara in Madison, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, I wanted to let you know I bought it looks like a bomb. It's for Japanese beetles.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a pheromone, and they fly into it. They get caught, and then they go into the cup that holds them. And a few years ago, probably 4 years ago, we had a tremendous amount of Japanese beetles, and they ate all my flowers. And so I bought two of these, and my grandson, we empty them out. There were about 2 cups a day. And if I see a Japanese beetle, and they usually start in July, I immediately put my catcher out there. And we have not had any problems in the neighborhood since I brought them into my yard.
Yeah, all your neighbors are happy.
They are. Your neighbors are loving you. They're probably going to buy you pheromone traps to put in your yard. Because what you do with that, and if you're okay with that and it is controlling the insects in general for you guys in the neighborhood, then continue to do that. What I would suggest, though, is perhaps you do like a lottery in the neighborhood, and so somebody else gets the pheromone traps this year, and, you know, maybe rotate it around, because pheromones do attract the insects. That's what they're for. But they don't just attract the insects in your yard. They attract them, as you noted, from your neighbors also. So you're bringing more into your yard. And if you're keeping up with it, oftentimes you can do just fine and it's not going to increase the damage in your yard. But do understand that pheromone traps attract them. And Japanese beetles have a 4-mile flying range. So just heads up. You know, if you have a spot outside of the neighborhood, maybe on the edges of the neighborhood where there are no houses, if you have a woods, the edge of a woods, something like that, you may actually even think about putting them out there so that you can trap them before they get to your house.
Yeah.
And that way you're keeping them away. You may see an increase to start with because they have to find those traps, but that might be a good alternative for you, for the entire neighborhood. And, you know, this is one of those problems. Deer and Japanese beetles are one of those problems that one homeowner, oak wilt also, are problems that one homeowner can't solve by themselves because the spread is so wide and the territory is so big that one person alone can make a dent maybe in their yard, but it's not a permanent fix. So working together with your neighbors is a great thing to control some of these issues.
Barbara, good luck and thank you for calling. Cheryl in Hales Corners, your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning. About 10 years ago, I put in a chameleon plant into my flower bed, and then I realized it was invasive and started pulling and getting rid of it. I thought I had gotten rid of it.
No, you
but
didn't.
Now, but yeah. It went dormant.
Uh-huh.
And it's heading to my fern peonies.
Mm-hmm.
How can I get rid of it?
Yeah, no. Yeah. You know what? That is edible. If we're thinking about the same plant, it is edible. In many cultures, they use it in cooking. If we're talking about the same plant, I'd want to identify it first before you put it in your mouth. But it is going to be that same type of control. Yes, it did go dormant. So you're looking at something that spreads by rhizomes underground, and you're either going to have it in dormancy and hopefully just ignore it, or you're going to have to dig that out and really, really get at it. This is another one of those, if you're not opposed to chemicals, that cutting and treating with some type of an herbicide that is safe for humans, etc. You cut it, paint it, and then that will help take care of it. But you have an awful lot of underground runners, so it will take a number of treatments in order to get that under control. Again, you could go to my technique of just, you know, digging everything out, sifting the soil. It's a pain, but if the area is not too huge, that would probably do it. Chameleon plant is often a great ground cover for really tough areas for other things to grow in. So, you know, you might want to just learn to love it too and move your fern, your ferny peony.
Thanks, Cheryl. Our guest, Liz Freemuth. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth. Her business, The Garden Hoe. She does horticultural services all around the country. And her website, thegardenhoe.com, or Garden Hoe, is it?
Thegardenhoe.com. Yeah, if you go to Garden Hoe, you might get something a little questionable.
Okay.
So, yeah. Put the in front of that, yeah.
Okay. Diane in Stevens Point has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Diane.
Oh, hello. My question is also about Creeping Charlie, but I'm at the point where I'm ready to try chemical control.
Mm.
So I was wondering if Liz had any pointers to carry out chemical control on Creeping Charlie.
Okay, where do you have your Creeping Charlie problem? Is it in grass, or is it in beds, or is it all of the above?
All of the above.
Yeah. And you don't love it enough to leave it alone, huh?
Well,
It's pretty much taking over.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And when it's in a happy spot, that's another one that I think the theme of the day is invasives. What are we going to, you know, what are we going to do about them? And it does take an awful lot of time year after year in order to control those. And the flower beds that they're in, are they perennial beds, annual beds, vegetables? What kind of beds are they in?
They're in a perennial bed and also in an area where I'd like to grow vegetables in the future.
Okay. Well, if it's a future project, that's good because it will take you a while to get that Creeping Charlie out of there. And the beds, especially the empty one, that's kind of an easy one if you're okay with chemicals, because you can spray that and just what happens, happens. The perennial beds, that gets a little bit more interesting because it is a plant that is going to be like your perennials in product control. So whatever you spray on that Creeping Charlie is also going to do wicked things to your perennials. So that gets to be a little bit more interesting for control. And Creeping Charlie is like the other ones that we've talked about today. It spreads beautifully by rhizomes underground, and it spreads by, you know, flower seeds. It spreads by everything, all of the above. Now, mine this year is looking absolutely fabulous. It's all over the place. Yeah. It's in the lawn. It's, you know, it will, really, you don't see it often, but every once in a while, I'll actually see it creeping up into the tops of the perennials and things like that. So if you have some larger plants, it's a cut it off and treat each individual stem. And I know, as I've said before today, these are huge tasks. This is not something that's a once and done or a 5-minute project. Controlling invasives is very, very serious business, and you have to keep at it. And Creeping Charlie is that.
It's
completely
best
and totally
in the fall, I think.
It's a number of times hitting it throughout the year. So if you hit it when it's in flower, you want to hit it at its weak point first. So you may have to hit chemicals and cutting, whatever you're going to do. And this goes for all of them. That when they're in their flowering periods, they're at their most vulnerable because they're expending the most energy and they're using the most energy. So the systems are a little bit weaker. So treating them in any form at that point is a good start, but it's not going to take them out completely and totally. So after we get a hard frost, then the systems go, hey, we need to store for over winter. And so they start sending nutrients into the roots. And so if you hit it with a chemical at that point, it's a way more direct route into that root, which is where you want that product to be.
Yeah.
And that's where it's going to kill it. And it takes a long time. It takes a very long, you know, multiple treatments. And
I think I've told this story on the show. A couple of houses ago, I eliminated my lawn, thinking I wanted to get rid of them, eliminated the lawn entirely, started over, and next year there was Creeping Charlie coming back from the neighbors.
Yes, yes. And I know a friend of mine has that. She's a lawn nut. She absolutely loves her lawn green and weed-free, a nut about it. The neighbor doesn't care. And so she treats hers, and then every year it creeps back over the line. And so it does, again, those are things, invasives of any kind, whether it's plants, insects, diseases, animals, you know, wildlife, whatever it is, a community approach is always more effective. And you may want to talk either to your neighbors or for one form or another, say, I have Creeping Charlie, you know, I'm sorry, I'm trying to eradicate it. They may not have it in their yard. They don't want it from yours either. So, you know, having good neighbor relations really does help with these invasives. But I think if you're not opposed to chemical, the open bed is the easiest one. The lawn is actually pretty easy, too, because you can have somebody come in and do a broadleaf weed control on your lawn, and that will help out quite a bit. The perennial beds, that's where it gets interesting because you have other broadleaves in there, and that gets a little tricky as to how you control.
Diane, that's what we got for you. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Nick in Manitowoc will give you a chance. Hi, Nick.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Actually, from St. Nazian's, but I have a question about our fuchsia.
Mm-hmm.
We overwintered it, and it's nice and green, but I'm not getting any blossoms.
How big is it?
It's pretty big. About 2 feet in diameter.
Wow. Have you overwintered this before, or was this just a last year's plant?
Yep. No, this is the second year.
Okay.
In the basement, kind of indirect sun. It never lost leaves. Hmm. It's healthy, but no flowers. And I know it's an annual, but I like it, so I want to keep it.
Well, it's an annual for us. Almost all annuals are perennial somewhere, unless they're a biological annual. And those, if you had flowers on it last year, did you cut it back at all when you put it in the basement?
No.
Okay. Will it hurt you to cut it back? Physically painful for you to cut it back?
No, not if it'll help.
Not if it'll help.
I would say you might want to do that because you may need to spur a little bit of growth. That, and has it been fertilized at all throughout the winter or spring?
Yep.
Okay, so what can happen, depending on what you did for fertilizer, it sounds like it's a beautiful, healthy plant if you've overwintered it a couple of times. A couple of issues that come to mind right away is that you need to spur some flower growth. And if it's been fertilized, it may actually be really healthy, but in a vegetative way. And what you want is you want to promote flowering on it. So I would go for a fertilizer for flowering plants. That's going to change that composition slightly, and it may be enough to
a little higher phosphorus.
Exactly. It's going to really push on the flowers as opposed to the leaves. And cutting it back a little bit, it's just going to make it thicker and prettier. I would do like a third off the top and just go to a flowering plant fertilizer and see if that doesn't get you a little bit of result. You may also think about repotting it. If it's a little bit root bound, it may not want to flower tremendously also. So you might want to slide that out of the pot. I know it sounds huge, but you may want to just get a tarp out, lay it on its side, slide the pot off and see what the roots are looking like. If they're starting to circle around, then you can cut those off. You know, you don't want to be positively brutal with it, but you can unfurl. You can do one of two things. You can either trim those roots off so that it's not circling the pot anymore, or you can tease those roots out of that circling habit, get it into a bigger pot, and then on you go.
Probably about one size up. I wouldn't go...
couple inches diameter difference is really all you want to do. Yeah.
Nick, thank you for calling. Good luck with that fuchsia. Appreciate it.
Again, send pictures.
Yes. Send us pictures. Betty in Asheville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a backyard that is almost totally shade. We have pine trees and a tulip poplar. And in the very back, we've always just kept mulch. But I was wondering if we could plant lilies of the valley around the edges just for something to be back there.
Yeah, you do understand that if they love where they're at, lilies of the valley will go wherever they want. So as long as you're okay with that, wonderful. You know, the leaves will disappear probably late summer, as soon as the heat kind of does its thing and they've rejuvenated their roots for the year, the leaves will actually disappear after a time. And if you're okay with that, lilies of the valley should do fine back there. The other plants that you can look at for shade, Brunera is wonderful. It's got heart-shaped leaves, and it has beautiful, pretty little blue flowers that stick up above the leaves in spring. And so they're just finishing up. I just have tail end of them right now on mine. And they are called often perennial forget-me-not. They're not technically forget-me-not, but that's what they're called, is perennial forget-me-not. And also, I would say hellebores would do beautifully back there also. There are a lot of different hellebores out there. That's an early flowering plant as well. Japanese painted fern would do well. Some of the native ferns that we've got, and you might want to look for upland wood type ferns, because those are going to tolerate a little bit less moisture. And with the type of plants that you've got there, I'm going to guess it's not a wet area. Mm-hmm. Those that are doing well. Hostas, if you have deer, don't even bother. But the other two, those are fine. Virginia is another, pig squeak is the common name. That will do very well in shade. It's got beautiful, big, glossy leaves. And so it'll give you a little bit different texture in there as well. Tree peonies do fairly well in shady areas, in dry, shady areas. And they do develop like a shrub. You don't have to, you know, as opposed to like the tree roses that we have, if you're unfamiliar, you do not have to dig those up and bury those. They're fine. They're cold hardy. They're beautiful. That could work there as well.
And Betty, good luck. Appreciate the call. Mark in Luck, Wisconsin, will go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a row of lilacs that were planted along the one side of the house about 13 years ago. And they keep getting super tall, super large, and we love the flowers, but I need to trim them back. And the year after we trim them back, there's no flowers, of course. And by the time they start flowering again, the second and third years after trimming, they're already back up to 10 or 11 feet tall, and it's time to trim them back again. Is there a way to prune lilacs without losing the bloom?
Yeah.
When are you pruning them?
When they're dormant, which would be November.
Yeah, no. Prune them now.
prune them now. And okay. Don't just trim the top.
No, don't trim the top.
Take the tallest ones, don't you?
I'm like a hedge. I bring them down.
You can do that if you want them hedge-like, but you're not going to get the best flowering out of them. What I would do is take a look first. You just take a step back. This is a beverage project. So grab yourself a beverage, and what you're going to do, it's two-step. Grab a beverage, go out there, get a chair, sit down, start looking at your lilac bushes. And what I want you to notice on there is the growth of it. Lilacs will have, and you can train them to be single stem. You can train them to have just a few big stems, but you will always get suckers at the base. And that's okay, because you do want that plant to rejuvenate and regenerate itself. But what you're looking at is you're looking at the oldest stems on there. And you want to take those oldest stems out right down close to the ground.
Right at the base.
And so don't worry about how horrible it looks right now. Don't worry about that. Just take out the oldest, ugliest stems. Those are the ones that are going to get you that really, really huge growth. So you want to get those out of there. And you're encouraging the growth at the base so that you get healthy, new growth, new development. But now is the time you want to prune your lilacs. Do not wait any longer to prune lilacs. That's for anyone out there. Don't wait. Just get out there and get it done, because you really, really want to get ahead of those bloom buds that should be starting to form right now. So that is probably why you didn't get much for growth and why it got taller before you got the flowers. You should have flowers just fine next year. And you can take it down as hard as you want every year. If you want to hedge clip that, that's your choice. That is your choice. But get rid of those big stems first, and then you'll actually have a hedge. But do not prune it after about the end of June, or you won't have any flowers.
There you go, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Liz Freemuth, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. You are listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with Liz Freemuth. Let's take another call. Natalie in Menominee, Michigan, will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling, Natalie.
Hi, Larry. Love all your programs. Listen, I like Creeping Charlie. Is it okay to leave it?
I like that I don't have to mow it.
You know what? I am with you on a lot of it. And I will say, let's justify our existence and our opinion on this. And they are doing a lot of breeding work on Creeping Charlie in Europe because it is a plant that does really well. And what is it that we don't like about it? Well, it's not right now. It's not the prettiest plant, and it goes where we don't want it to. Well, there are many instances where we do want a plant that's going to grow where nothing else grows. So, no, there are certain areas where, hey, I'm fine. Let the invasives do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So you're okay. I'm okay. How's that?
And I'm Thank okay. I got plenty of Creeping Charlie. Thanks a lot for calling, Natalie.
Well, I do have to say there was one turf grass guy on campus here a number of years ago that said his wife asked him why he was a turf grass specialist and he couldn't keep the violets under control on his own lawn. And he said, you know, sometimes you just got to pick a battle and that's not one of them.
And they are, and they do. They're their first blooming plants. Right. So for pollinators, they're great.
They're great. And, you know, the same thing with Creeping Charlie and some of the other ones, as long as it's not creating a health issue or a problem for you, you do have to make that choice. Do I keep it? Do I get rid of it? You know, what is it worth to keep it? What is it worth to get rid of it? And just figure it out from there. But the Creeping Charlie, I mean, it's a great pollinator as well.
Kel in Sugar Camp, we go to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a couple comments. I had a peony that was kind of in a shady area and had a beautiful Sarah Bernhardt, tough guy. And I had a beautiful flower 3 years ago. And then the next year, just leaves. And then last year, it never came up. And then I said, just left it. And it came up this year, and it's got a big, beautiful bud. So don't give up on your perennials.
I love that. I love it.
And the other thing I want to know is, do I need ants to cut away the sepals to make peonies bloom? And the other question, the other comment I had was shady plants. Woodland phlox, gorgeous blue.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I would agree with you that woodland phlox is fantastic. And it's a lowish grower, and it really, really does it. I'm going to guess that your Sarah had something going on with it, but there was enough root that was left that just came up. I might, because I'm one of those curious people, in August, on August 17th or thereabouts, I would probably go out and dig it up to see what you've got for root. And just to see if you had part of it die off and part of it has come back to life, because that's just fascinating. Why not, yeah. Right?
Why yeah, not? Why not? Kel, thank you.
Oh, and as far as the ants, we don't have an issue with not having ants. So honestly, I don't know whether we need to worry about it or not. There's ants all over the place. So
yeah, I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
Pete in McQuantico has a spirea shrub that's growing rather tall, wants it to grow wide. When and how should he prune to achieve this?
Kind of depends on which spirea you're looking at. Yeah. Because some of them are only, they have a certain habit. It may not be that it's ever going to get wide. It might be a taller type plant. If it is the white flowering spring spirea, you might be able to cut parts of it out and reduce the height. It may not get it may not add any width to it, but the perception may be that it's wider. You know, if you wanted to cover more space, I don't know that what you have is going to actually respond to pruning. I mean, we don't know what kind it is, so we can only guess. So if you want to reduce the height to give the appearance of wider, go for that. Go into the center of the plant or the, you know, outside edges, wherever the bigger stems are. Take those out. Those are going to be the higher growth ones. And just let the younger ones do what they're going to do. Otherwise, I'd say go shopping.
Yeah.
Get a new one.
Get a new one.
Get a new one. Get something else that's going to do what you want it to do without a whole lot of work.
Dave in Broadhead, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I've got a question. I've got bishop's weed, and as much
as it spreads like crazy, it's nice in a couple of areas, but it keeps going back to just plain green rather than keeping its variegated leaves. Is there anything you can do to keep the variegation?
No. What it's doing is it's reverting back to some of its parentage, and that can happen in some breeding over generations. And there really isn't a whole lot you can do about that. If you want to increase the amount of variegated leaves that you have in your stand, I would say go to the areas that have the variegation that you like, dig them up and move them around, and then get rid of the green, the solid green ones, because they're not going to go back to variegated. Once they revert to a solid green, I don't see them going back to variegation.
That's it for them.
Yep. Yeah.
Dave, thank you for calling. Megan in Black Creek emailed. She wants to go back to goutweed. She's had some success in some areas, but not others, and she is not willing to battle for the next 4 years. What chemical means do you recommend, and sort of what are the risks?
The risks with chemicals are always, it's chemicals. You know, the risks are health, the risks are collateral damage on plants that you didn't intend to kill. So what you want to watch out for, a couple of things, is when you're looking at treating, spray treating, chemical treating, any type of plant, you want to look 2 weeks out or as far as you can. Generally, you know, on most weather apps, you're going to get at least a semi-reliable 10-day forecast. So you look out for that 10-day forecast, and you want temperatures to be under 75. When you start getting up into the 80s, you're looking at revolatilization issues over a couple of weeks after that product has been put down. So you're looking at temperatures, and then you're also looking at wind. So really, if you're going to approach chemical control, you look all around you. You don't just say, okay, this is the chemical that's right for it. It's where am I putting it? What do I need to protect? What does the temperature look like? What does the weather look like? Most product, you are going to want to put it down and have it have a chance to dry before you walk away from that, and make sure that you post so that you're not walking through it. Pets and kids are kept away. They're not in it. Those are really the kind of most vulnerable. Anybody with lung issues, with chemical sensitivities, almost any type of sensitivity, you want to make sure that they're kept away from any kind of a spray site for quite some time. And dogs, definitely the pads of their feet, dogs and cats, that can be a very dangerous spot for them to pull chemicals in that they're walking on. So, you know, do be a little cognizant of that. As far as what products work well, it depends on what it is that you're looking at. If it's the gout weed, generally a glyphosate type product will work okay, an herbicide. And you can start with the least invasive as possible as far as your system goes, if that's possible with a chemical. But you're looking at starting with a low level, easily accessible chemical, and then working your way up to a brush killer if you need to, if it doesn't get it under control.
Speaking of control, I understand that you are the cicada champ. you have cicadas everywhere where you live, and I think you're the first person I've had on who's had the cicada bloom.
I love the cicadas. Love. 17 years ago, when the 17-year ones were out, Phil Pelletieri was still on campus full time, and he came down to our area so that we could do, I think actually he did a garden program with Shelley on cicadas down at Bigfoot Park. And so this has been, I love cicadas. I absolutely love them. The decibel level right now, we go out and we check every day. It was up to 70. And it's just absolutely fascinating to go out and wander where these cicadas are. We have them in our yard. We have them in the woods. I hear them in my bedroom. It's the first thing I hear in the morning is I hear that hum, and you'll get a little bit of it, a bit of sound difference where you get a high pitch and then a low pitch, and then you get the medium. And if you go in there, they kind of quiet down just slightly. And if you stay there long enough, then they actually start ramping it up. But I went into the woods, and there were beautiful, you could see the holes in the ground where they came up, And then all along on the leaves, real close to that, were the skeletons, you know, the shells, and they were on the plants. And oh yeah, I mean, we had them. I walked out this morning, and they were on the front porch. I think those are the ones that gave up because they looked pretty dead. There was one for a few days, and I'm going to say it's the same one, wanted to come in the house, and I'd pick it up and toss it back out on the lawn, and next day it would be back on the porch, and I'd toss it in the lawn. And then I had one die in my sandal, so I'm going to say it didn't make it. But it's such an interesting phenomenon, you know, that they really they lay eggs and they do a little bit of damage, but it's such a treat that nature is throwing our way.
Leave them on your lawn because they're good fertilizer. Ugh,
they're fantastic. You know, some people eat them, whatever.
Liz, a great pleasure. Thanks. We'll do this again. Appreciate it very much.
Love it. Thanks so much, Larry.
Liz Freemuth, her business is The Garden Hoe. Go to thegardenhoe.com. Take a look at her site there. And thank you for joining us today. We got a great team here. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive director is Jill Nadeau. And I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.